All right, we'll start the next session. My name is Rodney Honeycutt. I'm a division chair of the Natural Science Division. Excuse my accent, I'm from East Texas. That says a lot right there. I thought I would start with this slide because given this venue, this is a perfect slide, opening slide. So we're in a black box, so to speak. Before we start the discussion, I need to make an important disclaimer. I'm not a theologian. Don't ask me any theological questions like you did Dr. Duran. I'm a professor of biology, and my area of expertise is genetics and evolution. And for over 30 years, my research, teaching, and publications have focused on topics pertaining to the study of the evolutionary process. I consider evolutionary biology to be foundational for anyone conducting serious research in the life sciences. Therefore, I embrace the idea of Theodosius Dobzhansky, one of the founders of the modern synthesis of evolution, and also a very devout Greek Orthodox, when he states that nothing in biology makes sense except in light of evolution. Obviously, as a Christian and a scientist, I hold a worldview that accepts both the facts in support of evolution as a process and a faith in God as my Father and Christ as my Savior. I hasten to say, however, that I didn't become a Christian as a result of some great scientific insight or act of logical deduction. My faith resulted from a face-to-face conviction of who I was and who I wanted to be. In short, I encountered Christ and his teachings. And I did this after many years of being an evolutionary biologist. I was a professor at Harvard in the Department of Organismic and Evolutionary Biologists when I became a Christian. And so this verse is really what convicted me. On one occasion, an expert in the law stood up to test Jesus. "Teacher," he asked, "what must I do to inherit eternal life? What is written in the law, and how do you read it?" He answered, "Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your strength, and with all your mind, and love your neighbor as yourself. You answered correctly. Do this, and you will live." So this verse initiated a Bible study with two other Christians at the time, and it led to my subsequent baptism, and that was in 1986. Okay, so I'm a relatively new Christian. I would say that prior to that, I was probably like Darwin. I was more of an agnostic than an atheist. Okay, so that's my background. I didn't come from a fundamentalist background, and I wasn't accused of anything. My mother told me one time that she thought studying evolution had made me have some weird ideas. So there you go. So maybe that's true. So so I teach a course to first year seminar course to incoming freshmen at Pepperdine. And it can be students in different majors, not just biology. But I also give a similar lecture to our Biology 110 course on occasion. And the title of the course is Scientific Decision Making. And I asked the question, how do people make decisions about what to believe during the first week of classes? And I give them a set of statements like the ones I handed out. I'm sorry, I only thought maybe 10 people would show up, so obviously I was wrong. But these statements basically go from absolutely true to absolutely false, okay? And each student is asked to complete the questionnaire, and I actually give it to their parents as well. And so I compare the parents and the students in this questionnaire. And after the handouts are completed, we look at responses of students in comparison to their parents. So here's some examples. So as you can see right here, the parents don't agree with this statement. Man and apes evolved from a common ancestor. You can ask the question, why? Is it have something to do with education, something they've been exposed to? Are they changing their mind about the way they view the world as a result of educational exposure? And you can look at this question, which I find kind of interesting, that crime rates are higher when the moon is full. The students say definitely false, and the parents are a little bit more wishy-washy. Maybe that has to do with some old tradition a long time ago. Probably my grandmother believed that, for instance. Here's one where they both agree. Smoking causes lung cancer. Okay, now, back during the 1950s, nobody would probably believe that. But we've been bombarded with lots of scientific evidence and the news and the media and your doctors are telling you this, that smoking can cause lung cancer, and therefore it has an impact. So the thing is, though, is after we go through these comments, I talk about factors that influence what we believe. And so we discuss some decision-making rules, which can take many forms. Evidence or knowledge, for instance, education could have a big impact, or indirect evidence, some experience you've had, reliable sources, weighing consequences of right and wrong decisions. For instance, should I be vaccinated against the flu? Well, there's about less than a 1% probability I might get something from a flu shot, but there's a higher probability that you will get the flu if you don't take the flu shot. For instance, an interpretation of the information or intrinsic acceptance of risk. All these things are associated with decision-making rules, and there are factors that influence your decision-making rules. The media, authority, it could be your preacher, it could be a doctor, a parent, scientist, anybody. Culture, level of education, there are various sources of information that can actually impact us. So clearly, such factors can cause people to disagree. And that's the main point that I want the students to think about. How do you go through this? And even though some ideas are poorly supported, a large number of individuals still believe in a wide host of highly unsupported ideas. For instance, communication with the dead, 42%. By the way, Alfred Wallace, the co-discoverer of evolution, actually believed in seances and communicating with the dead. Okay, so there's a scientist who actually thought that too. Darwin thought it was rubbish, and he's probably right. There's also psychic experiences, ghosts. So you can see astrology. I find this really intriguing because if you look at the little survey I did, look at the students. Maybe true, whereas definitely false. This probably has to do with watching some of the recent Thor, for instance, Superman, those kinds of things. So maybe that's where they get that. But anyway, it obviously affects people differently. So decisions then can be complicated by many things. And I think I really want the students to be aware of that when they evaluate information. So I want to briefly go through the scientific method because I introduced students to this method. And the major point is that the scientific method is cyclical, with improvements being made constantly by testing hypotheses and modifying those hypotheses as we gain knowledge. It's a dynamic process and pertains to questions that lend themselves to the method. Okay, they have to lend themselves to the method. That's an important point. Such a process can lead to the development of a theory which has been thoroughly tested via the scientific method. A theory has been beaten up pretty good by scientists over the years in terms of experimentation. It's very different from a hypothesis. And the consequences of the method, it gives us great advancements that have been made as a result of applying this method. For instance, we've gone from the discovery of Mendel's laws to sequencing the human genome. Okay, we're actually learning a lot. We've learned a lot more by applying that method. So it's important to think about also in terms of what are some areas that just don't lend themselves to the scientific method. A great example is the criminal justice system that we have here. If you're found guilty, for instance, you can repeal under certain limitations. But what happens if you're found innocent? Can you be tried again for the same thing? No. Therefore, you can't revise it. Okay? So it doesn't lend itself to the same methodology. There's a limit to what you can see. In religion, you ask the question, can religious ideas, especially when it comes to faith and God and Christ, can we actually test those using the scientific method? Faith is very different. A religion adheres to a set of doctrines that are followed by all believers. And some of the components of the method are there. For instance, the goal of many religions is to encourage other people to become believers. Okay, there's a goal. Religions have specific models, such as there is only one God, and He is the creator of the universe. But then religions deviate from science primarily from the last three components. You don't need tangible data to believe in God. The scriptures and creation are your data. Faith is based on scriptures. And the creation reveals. and enforces and reinforces your faith. There is no process of evaluation and revision when it comes to religion. And I think that's important to remember. And I want the students to understand it, especially here at Pepperdine, because we try to deal with faith and reason, especially in the sciences. So there's some differences between science and religion. And we need to keep this in mind when we think about some of these topics that Chris talked about before. Science is materialistic. It takes a materialistic view of nature. It makes observations and experimentations that deal with facts and reason. The meaning is tested. And science is limited to natural phenomena and cannot provide ultimate explanations, especially of a religious nature. And some of these new atheists that make some of the statements they make are not being scientists. And religion is based on a metaphysical philosophy. It focuses on faith and things not visible. So it's a different type of evidence, and it's not scientific. Okay. Now, the conflicts in science have gone back a long way. Okay. Almost from the beginning, and especially with the Catholic Church. Now, a lot of the conflicts were really over interpretations of the Bible. Just think about the Inquisition is all you have to think about in terms of if you have a difference of opinion about something, especially if you're a scientist, you could run yourself aground pretty easily with the Pope or somebody like that at that time who had a lot of power, for instance. And you can think about, there are many examples, for instance, the flat versus the spherical earth. The Bible doesn't talk about the flat earth, but the Bible, in both the Old and New Testament, pretty much are flat earth philosophies, I mean, in terms of the way they define it. But it wasn't a big issue, but science, and it wasn't something that scientists necessarily refuted and proved Scripture wrong. It was just a way that you could interpret if you read certain things in the Bible. Probably the biggest controversy that got Galileo under house arrest had to do with the geocentric versus heliocentric universe. And this was a big issue. Kepler, Copernicus, Galileo, it actually goes back to the Greeks, some of these interpretations of the universe, and where the Earth stood relative to the Sun and the other universe. So it's laws of physics, for instance, you could think about some of the laws of physics, even Newton's laws, talk about the operation of the universe adhering to laws of physics that are not determined by discontinuous, disconnected, and arbitrary interventions. Okay, even physical laws could come into conflict there if you really start trying to interpret them a certain way. So this is not a new conflict. It started basically with Darwin, but Darwin, when he introduced it, he had a very receptive audience, okay? Because a lot of scientists have been thinking for a long time about this. And the fact that Alfred Wallace co-discovered it, continents apart, shows you how the writings and thinking at the time were having a big influence on them. So I view some of the issues pertaining to evolution as similar to some of the age-old arguments between science and religion. But there are also old arguments that date back. I think they were probably most profound when Darwin wrote his book on the Origin of Species. You realize, however, it took him 32 years to write that book. And so he was trying to amass a lot of support for what he was trying to get across. The idea of evolution itself as a process was accepted. Natural selection wasn't. And it wasn't even selected by a lot of the early geneticists. Okay, so it's not, that was very different. And that's something to think about. But it was key to his overall idea. Well, this new debate has created an interesting situation. We have books against evolution. Most of these come out of scientific creationism. And their primary argument is that there are areas that cannot be currently explained by science. There are observations about nature, like, for instance, William Dubinsky, in his Design Revolution, wrote, "The fundamental claim of intelligent design is straightforward and easily intelligible. Namely, there are natural systems that cannot be adequately explained in terms of undirected natural forces and that exhibit features which in other circumstances we could attribute to intelligence." That makes sense, but to a scientist, it doesn't make sense, because if you're proposing something that can be tested for scientific, we all know as scientists, if you're talking about a natural phenomenon, that's what we work on. Okay. There are also books against religion. And these books are in response to primarily advocates of intelligent design, and they all go way beyond real science. Okay. When they get off in Richard Dawkins especially is a lousy theologian, okay? He doesn't know anything about the Bible. And some of his statements are just absurd. But at the same time, they're called the New Atheists. Dawkins said he held off writing this book for a long time because he didn't think it would be very well received. It was on the national bestseller list for weeks in America when it first came out. Now you can buy it for about $5 at the bookstore, but one time. But he makes some statements in The God Delusion. One is, there's something infantile in the presumption that somebody else has a responsibility to give your life meaning and point. The truly adult view, by contrast, is that our life is as meaningful, as full, and as wonderful as we choose to make it. Now, Jerry Coyne is actually a pretty good book about evolution, but when he sticks on that topic, but he is vehemently opposed to any religion, okay? And he thinks atheism is the only way to think about things. So he says that selection is both revolutionary and disturbing for the same reason. It explains apparent design in nature by a purely materialistic process that doesn't require creation or guidance by supernatural forces, okay? That's the other side. The new atheism. Okay, I find myself in this camp, which is sometimes makes me feel like Daniel in the lion's den, but in the sense that some scientists are trying to defend faith and reason. And I've given you three books here: The Language of God by Francis Collins, Ken Miller's book, Finding Darwin's God, and my friend Robert Asher, Evolution and Belief. This is interesting. Rob's been my friend for a long time. He's at Cambridge University. Until this book came out, I didn't even know he was a Christian. Okay, but here's something that Ken Miller says. To be sure, genuine faith requires from its adherents a trust in God, but it also demands a confidence in the power of the human mind to investigate, explore, and understand the evolving nature of God's world. And this is something Rob says. We can no more justify atheism due to evolution than claim the non-existence of Thomas Edison due to electricity. I reiterate Darwin's own argument that his theory presents a mechanism by which life has diversified, representing a cause which says nothing about any potential agency behind it. And that's a really good quote.
Dr. Honeycutt, could you prioritize those books for Busy Evil as far as reading them?
Well, this is Rob Asher's. Is that what you mean? Yeah. That's the second one. And then Finding Darwin's God, Kenneth Miller is the first one, okay? In terms of the quotes?
Terms of the prior guide, if I were to read one, which one do you suggest read first?
Jay Brewster likes The Language of God. I tend to like Finding Darwin's God. So it's just really, it's an interesting thing about it is we kind of all, these kinds of scientists, we all converge to a large extent on how we deal with scientific fact in our faith. And I find that refreshing, the fact that we do. So it really depends. You can start with any one of them and it'd be good. If you want to read about paleontology, Rob is a really good paleontologist. And his book actually got good reviews by paleontologists, which is good to say. So when you think about what is evolution, Darwin's book entitles it The Origin of Species, described by his theories addressing descent with modification. That does infer common ancestry. And he developed his ideas on some very astute observations. He was an observer as much as an experimenter. He saw variation within species. He saw relationships between extinct and living species. He saw traits that were shared among species, suggesting a common ancestor. And his theory is an attempt to explain the diversity of life as a result of adaptations, shared ancestry, in the process of natural selection. And as I said before, the timing was right. Darwin, he reached an audience that was already ready to receive that information, because a lot of other scientists, including Charles Lyell, who was kind of Darwin's mentor, were coming to that conclusion. Also, but Lyell said he didn't accept natural selection, okay, as a process. They thought it was too weak. So it's an interesting thing. So what are some of the conflicts between Christianity and evolutionary theory that we see today? Well, there are lots of them, and some of them go back all the way to Darwin. There's this idea of the constancy of the species, which means that you have these, it actually goes back to Plato about the essence of the, you know, within the kind you see consistency within the kind, but another one, there's no overlap. Okay, they're each a unique creation. So it suggests, it really suggests a static world, not a changing world. But what Darwin was trying to address is the fact that you do have a lot of variation. There is changes. There's actually been a lot of change in through the geological and paleontological record. Fossil forms similar to living forms, for instance. And this, beyond a shadow of a doubt, I think he really demonstrated very accurately. Descent with modification is the one, like Chris said, that causes a lot of trouble. Because basically what it says is that man, like other organisms, is part of the tree of life. Okay, and we share a common ancestry with chimpanzees. In fact, I always ask my students, would you rather have a heart transplant from a baboon or a chimpanzee? If that was the only choice you had, okay, which would you like to have? Chimpanzee or baboon? Chimpanzee, me too, because there's about 30 million years separating me from the baboon, okay? It may have a heart similar to mine, but from an evolutionary standpoint, we're a lot more similar, and even genetics, for that matter. But it's a problem, and it goes back to how we view ourselves in relation to God, and what the image of God really means, and special creation really means. And of course, the young Earth, I think, was something that was considered a lot more seriously later on, but the Earth has been proven to be more than 6,000 years old, and I always tell people that we talk about accuracy and precision in science, and no metric that's off that much from 6,000 years would be used by a scientist, okay, 4 billion years. So it's just not feasible to think about the Earth being that young. And again, a lot of these ideas were proposed by the Bishop of Usher, for instance, who wrote a really interesting paper about the age of the Earth, following genealogy and historical information. It was a good hypothesis. It just isn't correct, at least based on the scientific evidence. And, of course, this one is a real problem, natural selection and the absence of perfection. You can think of natural selection as a tinkerer. It uses what it has. You'll never see Pegasus arise from a horse. You know why? Because a bird's wings are the same as a horse's front limbs, okay? New limbs are not going to arise from nothing, okay? Natural selection doesn't work like that. You can think about the whole process as being chance, mutations arising, anti-chance. Selection is an anti-chance process. It selects for some organisms that have certain specializations that are better than others, okay? And it acts on variation in a population. That's why in another 20 years we won't have any antibiotics to fight any of these microbes, because they're a lot better than we are at evolving. And they evolve a lot faster. And so as a result, they're going to beat us unless we come up with some way to avoid it. So that natural selection, though, as I said before, was a process that was considered too weak to be accounted for as the major mechanism for evolution to occur. And really, it wasn't until theoretical population geneticism until the 1930s actually demonstrated how selection could work that it actually people started realizing that that select, it was possible to get the change. Now, somebody mentioned the idea about the Cambrian explosion. We see in the fossil record, and we see in groups of organisms, examples of increased speciation over very short periods of time. And the original people in the modern synthesis proposed that evolution was gradual. And that's kind of what Darwin talked about. But there are good examples. Actually, I work on one in South American fishes where we call it an adaptive radiation. You see this burst of species arising at a very particular period of time. It had to occur rapidly, okay? And it's been debated for a long time among evolutionary biologists about how prominent is saltational or rapid evolution in the diversification of certain groups of animals. And I'll contradict Dr. Duran. We talk about macro and macro evolution a lot. There's a book written by a paleontologist, Steve Stanley, called Macro Evolution. The issue is, can the same process that you see acting in populations with natural selection, can those changes at the micro level occur when you see major changes at the macro scale over evolutionary time? If you take a tree of life of all mammals, for instance, if you look at a mouse and an elephant, they're pretty different, right? But they share a common ancestry. Can you account for that using the same processes that you see going on in populations? And there's a lot of discussion about that. I think with evolution and development now, it's even gotten more complicated. There's a group, there's a field in biology called Evo-Devo, where they actually talk about how do you explain how gene expression could drastically change, say, the digits of a mouse becoming the length of a bat's wing, with just a mutation causing an upregulation of a particular gene. How do you fit that in the context of mutations occurring in populations and selection acting upon it? We haven't been able to put that in a total context yet. The point is a lot of these things we debate all the time. I taught an evolutionary biology course this semester, and we talked about micro and macro evolution and some of the issues that are still being debated about those processes. See, nothing's sacred to scientists, okay? We don't mind disagreeing. In fact, if I could come up with a better theory in evolutionary biology, I would gladly propose it and take credit for it. So is it possible to reconcile one's Christian faith with evolutionary theory? Well, I'd like to just give you a few points. Point one, I'll quote Michael Ruse, who's a philosopher. He's not a Christian, but he's at least logical and also objective. He says, Christian faith cannot remain static and untouched, but must move forward creatively to meet the challenges. Therefore, as Christians, we should remember that we have a brain large enough to contemplate the mysteries of God, and this means understanding both science and the true meaning of Scripture. Number two, don't confine God to a human conception. For instance, view God's creation from an evolutionary perspective. His creation is not stagnant, like any creation that I could create, for instance. Rather, his is a dynamic and ever-changing creation, full of life and ever-renewing. When viewed through this lens, God's creation is even more awesome. Three, Genesis is not a how-to book. At least I don't see it as a how-to book. And if they'd started studying the Bible with me, starting in Genesis, telling me it was a how-to book, I wouldn't have become a Christian. They started in the book of John. Okay. In contrast, Genesis says, be still and know that I am God. I will be exalted among the nations. I will be exalted in the earth. Four, although our fate is like that of other animals in that we all die, humans are probably the only animal that contemplates their mortality. Moreover, as Christians, we live in expectation of a better life. And that's pretty unique. That is special. Okay. Now, some of the students here said, well, when did that occur? And I said, well, you know, they asked me a question, when did the soul rise? I have no idea, okay? But the point is, though, it is an interesting question. I said, well, you know, the Neanderthal man, Homo erectus, buried implements with their dead, okay? That implies to me that they understood that when you die, maybe you're going to go somewhere else. You know, so, I mean, it's an interesting thing. I have no answers to that, per se. And finally, what is the image of God? To me, God is spirit, and his worshipers must worship in spirit and truth. And I think that's very important. So when you think about it, then, I had to ask this question. also, what should you teach? We should teach our children. And I think it's very important to avoid setting up your children with beliefs that can be refuted by science. I told both my daughters, who are very strong Christians, that just because you're a Christian doesn't mean you have to turn off your brain. It's okay to question. It's okay to think. And I want them to have a foundation that's based upon something more than some scientific theory that can be refuted because it's being proposed as science. And I also think it's important to have a sound doctrine. I like 1 Timothy 16, watch your life and doctrine closely, preserving them, because if you do, you will save both yourself and your hearers. And I think that's important to remember when we think about our children, especially if you want to see the next generation coming to these types of meetings that we have. So finally, I had to ask this question. So can a Darwinian be a Christian? And I think it's important to ask that question. And Michael Ruse wrote a really nice book about this. And you can see here his quote, "We do not have the powers which will necessarily allow us to peer into the ultimate mysteries. If nothing else, these reflections should give us a little modesty about what we can and cannot know, and a little humility before the unknown." That's something that's totally lacking in the new atheist, in what they propose. And it's a misunderstanding about us as Christians. And finally, I'll quote Darwin. "I see no reason why the views given in this volume should shock the religious feelings of anyone." In fact, he said, "I never said that I was a total non-believer." He didn't say he was a Christian. He was probably an agnostic, would be more like it. At least he was receptive. And his wife was a very devout Christian. So that's all I have to say. Don't ask any theology questions unless you want Dr. Brewster to answer them.
I really enjoy reading the ICR, the Institute of Creation Research, Younger Creationists, and they brought up something that's very interesting. They said that evolutionists have found red blood cells.
Red blood cells.
Evolution scientists have discovered red blood cells in dinosaur bones. Mm-hmm. And I'm just curious if you've heard about that. Just one, but multiple.
Yeah, the red blood cells and dinosaur bones. When I was at the National Science Foundation, we funded there's this guy named Jack Horner who believes that dinosaurs were warm-blooded, okay? And he claimed that he had a T-Rex fossil that had some red blood cells in it. And so we had this thing called a rapid grant for a small amount of money. And so he was going to isolate DNA from the red blood cells, to compare it, to look at the dinosaur. It turned out not to be. So
there's many bases to it.
The problem is, when you start talking about dinosaurs, there's not very much left. It's mainly minerals in those fossils. Now, of course, in Neanderthal man, for instance, they have sequenced the entire genome of Neanderthal man, because there's still enough biological material that you can do that. But I'm a little skeptical of some of these old fossils and what you can find. Now, I'm pretty amazed at some of the plant fossils, though, because they're remarkably complete and still have chlorophyll in them in some cases.
Yeah. How about carbon C14 that they found in diamonds, and carbon C14 can't last more than thousands of years, and also they don't use big fossils. What's your thoughts on carbon C14?
Like I said before, with a lot of these dating methods do vary depending on what level of time you're talking about. Like, for instance, volcanic ashes have been used for more recent human origin type of things. But like I said, these measurements are accurate, okay? And they're consistent in different parts of the world. So the scientists, I'm not going to try to reinvent the wheel here, okay? That's an area of science that I'm clearly not an expert in. But again, it's been utilized and examined in a lot of detail. So if you start attacking science like that, if you go back and say, well, look, the scientists were long 200 years ago, they were the first to admit they were. It's, it changes. It depends upon the type of information, the type of tools we have to do the testing. There are lots of factors that influence what we do. But what good is it going to do to just try to spin a lot of tales to refute scientific fact to fit what you believe?
Well, it goes against the Bible. Like Exodus 20:11, when God's talking about the Ten Commandments, in no way questions the Ten Commandments as a Christian. But right in the middle of the Ten Commandments, God said, made the whole world in 6 days. And then he compares it to the work week, that he made the world in 6 days, the rest of the seven, and how we're supposed to be saved. But if God made the world in millions of years, that doesn't make any sense.
What's most important to me, you know what the hardest thing for me is? The Ten Commandments. Actually obeying them. And so that's the whole thing about what's the most important thing about Christians? Loving your neighbor as yourself. Okay? Let's get this right. What's the most important thing about our doctrine? Is it debates over evolution and faith? Or is it trying to live a life like the Bible tells us we should live? That's what I struggle with most.
Remember who the Creator was, though.
I know who
Christ
the Creator
is. Christ is the Creator. So if you don't believe Him that he created, then how are you supposed to believe Him later?
It doesn't bother me. I can perfectly
believe in one place and not believe Him in the other. And he said that He
I believe
there.
Who He says He is. Okay? I mean, I came to Christ because of that. I don't have to sit here, but at the same time,
scientific theory, science is looking at things that you can observe
and experiment
and
with. I can't
and
do that.
And you can't do that.
No.
And you know, when you're talking about the age of the earth, I mean, if you had Adam standing in front of you as an adult human being, and you as a scientist, because he was created as an adult human being, try to tell me how old he was and what he looked like as a baby, you would be marching down a road you couldn't do anything about. It's like the earth. I mean, if the earth was created as an adult thing, it was created as a whole, then how are you going to tell me how old it is?
Well, I guess, you know, you can...
How are you going to tell how old it is?
You can buy the argument, but what good does it do? How would that advance science at all to believe that? I mean, I'm talking as a scientist now. It's just not something that's a big issue to me about my faith.
I don't see faith as being totally something you have to believe on something you can't see. Because God is there in front of our faith in everything we do every day. And He holds all of these different factors that allow life to happen on Earth. I mean, we look for life on other planets. But there would have to be so many different things put in order for life to exist on another planet.
I have no argument with that. In fact, one of my...
But all those factors have to be in place. I mean, there's gravity, there's distance from the sun, there's...
all kinds of things.
Our place within the galaxy, you know, where we are within our galaxy, and being in a spot just the right Goldilocks spot within our galaxy, just the right Goldilocks spot within our solar system. There's so many things that God is controlling every day.
I'm not going to argue, but God can control things. I mean, why would I pray to Him
visible,
if I didn't think He could control
things?
He's
visible.
If I could just quickly give you two questions. I think something everyone can agree on is that Darwin doesn't really deal with the origin of life. How does life come from God? Whether we believe in evolution or not. I mean, evolution doesn't explain the origin of life.
Right. You know what? And there have been some really interesting experiments done to see, you know, can we create a cell...
Yeah.
Multicellular organisms. Some of the really interesting experiments were done, but they haven't created life. Okay,
right.
And if you take E.O. Wilson, you know who E.O. Wilson is?
Yeah.
He says if you go from the very original life all the way to modern times, it becomes an eternal metaphor. Okay.
Because what?
Eternal metaphor. And I think that's where the humility part comes in. How much can we prove with science?
Uh-huh. Sir, you had mentioned Michael Behe's book, Darwin's Black Box. And if I recall, he deals with the irreducible complexity in that book and the bacterial flagellum and how each of those parts is necessary to that motor
Do you want your faith based upon what Michael Behe says about the flagellum?
Well, I don't. About your comment that motor-cam system, every part is there. How did that develop evolutionarily?
Bit by bit. You still share things with fish that you'd be surprised about.
Like a human eyeball, I mean, all different.
And you know what? And your human eyeball is sorry compared to a squid's eyeball.
I said, your eyeball is not near as functional or near as perfect as a squid's eyeball.
Maybe
God
designed this
for
design.
Why didn't you
use
a bad one?
Design for different things.
Maybe it's
from
the
lot.
What?
Is it for me?
Yeah.
Okay.
Lady over here has a
question. Oh, so I'm wondering if you think that if common descent is true, then the problem of evil might be a little more exacerbated. I'm wondering if you think we need to have a good explanation for why particular kinds of evils are in the world and some of the animal suffering prior to humans coming into the world might pose a challenge for explaining why. So one question, do you think we need to...
The problem about the issue of evil is philosophical. And that's different from... There are lots of questions that
Sorry.